Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast. This week I'm talking with Father Jim Martin about his book, Jesus, A Pilgrimage, which comes out on March 11th. But first, I want to let you know that this podcast is brought to you by St. Bonaventure University, which will be holding a special conference on the legacy of Thomas Merton called Coming Home and Going Forth, Merton as Mirror and Model, from June 19th through 22nd. For the full schedule and registration information, visit sbu.edu/Merton. Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast, and I'm joined this week by my colleague and editor-at-large at America, Father James Martin. Welcome, Father Jim.
Thanks, Tim. Good to be here.
Well, I'm very excited and very honored that you're doing your first kind of podcast interview about your new book, Jesus, A Pilgrimage, with us, so thank you for that.
My pleasure. Happy to do it here at America.
Well, I've been, you know, we've been talking about your book for a long time as you've been working on it, so I feel like I've been hearing about it for a while, but, you know, our readers, I think, are very excited about it, and we have an excerpt in this issue called Take Up Your Cross, the March 3rd issue, The Risen Christ in Daily Life. But maybe you can start about, you know, there's so many books written about Jesus. Why did you decide to write one yourself, and how is it different than maybe some other books on Jesus?
Well, that's a good question. I think I had always wanted to write a book about Jesus. Obviously, as a Jesuit, I've been thinking about Jesus ever since I entered 25 years ago. He is the center of my life. And also, you know, from a kind of a natural point of view, I've always been interested in books on Jesus. I love reading books on the historical Jesus, on the Christ of faith, and I wanted to sort of put my own oar in the water. I think what's different about this book is that it combines what's called the Jesus of history, and by that I mean sort of insights about what life was like in first century Palestine and what we can know about Jesus's life and times in Nazareth and Galilee, with the Christ of faith, so the one who does miracles, the risen one. And I think one of the things that's frustrated me about some Jesus books, many Jesus books, is that they either look at the historical Jesus and they look at, you know, what life was like around those times and, you know, try to look at archaeological finds and sociological studies, and they sort of ignore the Christ of faith. They say we can't talk about the miracles. Or they are books that look at the Christ of faith, you know, the risen one and where he is in our faith, and they say we're going to ignore sort of mere historical things. But my point in this book is that we have to look at Jesus, you know, as a whole. You know, the Jesus of history is the Christ of faith. And so I'm trying to bring those two things together in the book, and I'm very excited about it. I hope people really enjoy it.
Yeah, the chapters are set up in that way. You know, it's kind of, you've got anecdotes about your trip to the Holy Land, which we'll talk about, but also your studies and the people you've read in historical Jesus scholarship, and then your own spiritual reflection. So it's kind of part historical study, part memoir, part spiritual guide.
Yeah, and I use a trip to the Holy Land, as you say, a pilgrimage I took with another Jesuit friend about 2 years ago to kind of flesh out some of the historical Jesus stuff. And the book obviously follows Jesus's life, you know, so from the Annunciation to the birth, to the baptism, and through his public ministry and the Passion and the Resurrection. But as you say, each chapter has a little pilgrimage, so you learn a little bit about the site where we are, a little biblical exegesis, so a bit of a deep dive into the gospel stories in question, and then a little spirituality, you know, what does this passage have to say to you today? So, you know, each of these genres, I think, can be appealing to different kinds of readers, and I think different readers will be drawn in by different genres in the book.
Now, you draw on a wealth, as you said, of Jesus scholarship in this book. It's very impressive. Who were kind of your principal guides as you set out, like in terms of the scholars out there?
Yeah, I'm happy to say that because I'm happy to thank them. The late Father Dan Harrington, who just died actually about a week ago, was my professor of New Testament at Weston Jesuit School of Theology, now Boston College School of Theology of Ministry. He's sort of my biblical hero, and I dedicate the book to him. He not only taught me the New Testament, but also has a wonderful series of books called the Sacrapagina series of Bible commentaries that are just terrific. And that was really kind of my second Bible. The other person I relied heavily on was John Meyer. His series of books called A Marginal Jew, which looks at the historical Jesus, were incredibly helpful. And then, funny enough, the other person I used a lot for the Holy Land stuff was Jerome Murphy O'Connor, a Dominican priest who recently also died. His terrific book, The Holy Land, was a guide I used while I was in the Holy Land. So one of the things I'm really excited about this book is that I bring that this kind of academic stuff, basically, that I think is often just reserved for scholars, into a more popular book. So I use these Bible commentaries and, you know, sometimes abstruse bits of research and try to make it accessible for the contemporary reader.
So speaking of the Holy Land, you mentioned Jerome Murphy O'Connor's book. You write in the beginning that you were initially maybe slightly reluctant to go, thinking maybe, well, I can write this book perhaps without going to the Holy Land. Why were you reluctant? Why were you eventually convinced this was a good idea?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, our former editor, Drew Christensen, figures into this. Well, basically, you know, like a lot of Jesuits and a lot of Christians, I had prayed about these stories, and I thought, I don't want my sort of beautiful images of the Holy Land and, you know, what Bethlehem looked like and Nazareth looked like and the Sea of Galilee looked like to be kind of supplanted by, you know, kind of tourist sites. I didn't want to be, you know, have my mental images ruined. But our former editor, Drew Christensen, said, you know, you have to go to the Holy Land to get a sense of Jesus's life and times. And boy, was he right. You know, you get a sense of the groundedness of the Gospels. And you just, for example, the area in Galilee, you understand the Gospels. When they talk about Jesus goes from this side of the lake to the other side, you sort of see that and you understand, you know, what that meant. And that's the reason why the Holy Land is called the Fifth Gospel. You really, it teaches you. And it was a sort of a life-changing experience for me. I was so glad I went. And I'm very grateful to Drew, too, for his recommendation.
Well, as you mentioned, you traveled with your friend, another Jesuit, George Williams. What was most surprising to you about visiting there in terms of the territory, the people?
I think the most surprising thing was how little the area around the Sea of Galilee has changed. I mean, you know, you go to Jerusalem, obviously, and it's changed in 2,000 years, but the Sea of Galilee is essentially the same. It is not developed along the shoreline. And when you go to Capernaum, where Jesus had his home base in Galilee during his public ministry, there's nothing there. I mean, there are ruins there, but there aren't these, you know, huge churches and, you know, touristy sites. And you can stand on the shore, and I talk about this in the book, and look out over this pristine lake and realize that you are seeing exactly what Jesus saw. We know he lived in Capernaum. You know, we know he was there for a while, and we know he lived sort of on the shoreline, and Peter's house is right there. And even if it's, you know, somewhere a few hundred yards away, you can say that Jesus saw this. And realizing that was extraordinary to me, and I was delighted that I found it was so unchanged.
Now, this story is a big book, 500 pages, right, but organized well, and I think it's something people could dip into and like pick out a story, a piece of the gospel story if they want to read about. How'd you come up with the structure? There are one-word headlines, you know, a rejection, Nazareth, Bethlehem. You're picking out parts of these stories and reflecting on each of them.
Yeah, as I said, I wanted to, you know, follow the course of Jesus' life. And so there were some chapters that I had to include. So the Annunciation, you know, the Nativity, those kinds of things. But then the ones in the public ministry were stories that I felt that I really had something new to say or that were very meaningful to me, as well as stories that, you know, reflect places that we visited. So, for example, we go to Jericho, which is where the story of Bartimaeus and Zacchaeus, the blind man and the rich man who's up in the tree, happen. I like the idea of the one-word titles. Most of them are locations, so Gerasa, you know, from the Gerasene demoniac, Nazareth, Bethlehem, because I wanted to give people the idea as they open the book that this is, in fact, a pilgrimage, you know, from place to place to place. And I'm happy with the structure, and it's 25 chapters, and you know, obviously it's not every story in Jesus's life, but they're the stories that are the most meaningful to me and the ones I feel the strongest about. So I'm happy with how it turned out structure-wise.
Now, why don't we talk a bit about the scholarly part, and then we'll turn to the more spiritual part. In terms of the scholarship, how did you, I mean, you're drawing on these wealth of resources. I know there are competing arguments and about some of these stories. How did you balance all of that in trying to give kind of a fair representation of historical scholarship?
Well, it's a good question. Most of the times the scholarship agrees. And so you look at different commentaries and they agree on an interpretation of a particular Greek word. For example, I bring in a lot of Greek because I enjoy that. But sometimes there are you know, scholars that disagree. One of the most interesting discussions I had was with scholars about the idea of Mary in Nazareth and whether or not she was a powerless person. And I should say I sent the book out to about 20 expert scholars to read it. And you know, people like Dan Harrington and Amy Jill Levine, who's a Jewish New Testament scholar and looks at it through a Jewish person's eyes. But for example, I would say feminist scholarship of the 1980s would say Mary is powerless and sort of, in a sense, asserts her authority you know, in a patriarchal system by saying yes to the angel Gabriel so that you could say she's powerless. But Amy Jo Levine said, well, you know, actually more recent scholarship shows that women were not completely powerless in first century Palestine. They could sort of have businesses and things like that. And so to be able to kind of take that and distill it and, you know, and come up with my own interpretation, that's, you know, I think somewhere in the middle, basically. So with these, you know, readers, you know, who got back to me and provided me with, you know, fascinating commentary, I was able to sort of find a middle ground. So this is what I would say. These are the most reasonable conclusions that are in scholarship today. You know, I'll tell you a funny story. Some of the scholars would write back and say, have these great insights, and they would say very politely, well, Jim, as you know, blah, blah, blah. And these are great insights. And, you know, I wrote right back and say, I didn't know that, but thanks. And I'll be incorporating that into the book.
Now, maybe two ideas that you talk about that are interesting, maybe a little, you know, debated. Jesus's consciousness, you know, about what do we know about what he knew about who he was?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think that's kind of the sort of borders of what we know about Jesus. Father Dan Harrington once, when asked what was Jesus thinking at this point in his life, during someone asked him this in class, he said, we have no idea. But, you know, we have to think about, you know, Jesus had a human consciousness, so he must have learned, but he also had a divine consciousness. And the question is, the big question is, did he know everything? How did he understand his vocation as the Son of God, the second person of the Trinity? Elizabeth Johnson always says, well, he wouldn't have used those terms. But how did he understand his ministry and his vocation? I mean, at some point, you know, at the wedding feast of Cana, he begins to do miracles, right? Even earlier than that, at the baptism, you know, he has this dramatic event at the baptism. So how did he understand it? I think that a sort of defensible ground, and I think a reasonable hypothesis, is that he grew in his understanding of his vocation. And I think you can work your way through the Gospels and see him kind of coming to understand his vocation. That's not accepted by everyone. You know, some people say he didn't understand it until Easter. Other people say he understood it, you know, one sort of extreme version, which, you know, could be true, is that he understood it from the moment of his conception. But I tend to think that he grew in his understanding. And I talk a little bit about the question of what's called Jesus' self-consciousness in the book a little bit.
And one other question. This interests me. What was Jesus' central message that he was bringing? I mean, you say some people think it's reaching out to the poor, but it actually was not that.
Yeah, it really is the reign of God, often called the kingdom of God. That's the kind of organizing principle of all of his preaching. And everything sort of falls into place when you think about him proclaiming the reign of God. And really, the reign of God, which is also kind of complicated because we really don't know, you know, what is it exactly? He uses parables to describe it because it can't be kind of contained in a definition. But we don't know when it is, where it is. Theologians sometimes say it's the already, but the not yet. It's already here because Jesus is here, but obviously it's not yet here because, you know, we still live in a world of violence and injustice and suffering. So I try to tease that out a little bit in the book as well. I find that also a fascinating concept.
Now, let's maybe turn to the spiritual part of it. One of the things I found moving about the book was your own reflections on what these stories, how they spoke to you, and how you learned from certain passages and sayings of Jesus. One in particular, this chapter on immediately, where you talk about your struggle with some of your own sinful nature. And so this isn't a book where you're kind of preaching and holding yourself up necessarily as an exemplar. You're kind of a fellow seeker, a fellow sinner, if I can say that.
Yeah, no, I am. Like as Pope Francis said, I'm a sinner. And, you know, I really wanted to include that. I think that's the part of the book I'm most excited about, the spirituality part. Because once again, books on the historical Jesus rarely include spiritual reflections. And spirituality books rarely include a lot of scholarship. And I try to sort of bring that in. Yeah, you know, before I wrote this book, I reviewed all of my retreat journals for the last 25 years to try to look at places in prayer where I gained some insight into these passages. So I include a lot of those experiences and insights, you know, for the reader. But as you say, I also include places where these passages have helped me in struggles. You know, we all struggle. And I think for me that the books that I most appreciate are the ones where the authors are honest about their struggles and honest about their failings and their sinfulness. And so I try to incorporate that in the book and be, you know, pretty vulnerable in front of the reader because, you know, it's why not be honest? These passages, these really are my favorite passages, and I've learned a lot, and I want to try to help the reader gain insight for himself or herself as well.
Now, as a Jesuit, somebody who wrote a book, The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything, what did your Jesuit spirituality, how did it help the book? What did it bring to your study of Jesus?
I would say two things. One, as most of our readers and listeners know, Ignatian contemplation helps you to enter into a scene imaginatively. And so I share with, after the scholarship, I say, let's look at this imaginatively, what might have happened. And so I think that helps to sort of enable the reader to really enter into the scene, whether it's by the Sea of Galilee or, you know, at Gethsemane or at Golgotha or even at the resurrection with Mary Magdalene. So that helps. And I talk about the multiplication of the loaves and the fishes. And in John's version, there's a little boy who brings the basket of loaves and fishes. And I say, you know, who was this kid? You know, where did he come from? You know, did his parents say, go and give our basket of food to Jesus? And I think that kid is actually kind of an interesting emblem for me, because the kid comes on into the Gospels. He provides the basis for the miracle, and then he leaves. And I use it as an example of how someone can bring a little, you know, two fish and a few loaves, and God can make a lot out of it. And I use that as a kind of spiritual jumping off point for the way that God can kind of multiply what little we bring in life, you know, whether it's a small act of charity or a little kind act that we do, and multiply it. So that's the first thing, the Ignatian contemplation. And then the second thing is finding God in all things. I try to illustrate some of these chapters and these passages with stories of people that I've met, you know, whether it's in Jamaica or when I was working in East Africa in Nairobi, or, you know, in our parish in New York City, and remind people that the risen Christ is present in people and places and events. And I think that's a little Jesuit spirituality that helped me out a lot.
Now, how do you see this as a piece, this book, with your, I mean, you've written many books now. You mentioned the Jesuit spirituality book, but also, you know, yeah, your book on humor, your lives with the saints. Obviously, Jesus is central to all of those stories.
Yeah, honestly, I see all those books as kind of leading up to this one. I don't think I've ever written a book that has meant as much to me, or that is as important to me, or that I try to get so, you know, right, if you could say that. I mean, I really worked hard on this book, and I want it to be the best that I could do. And I, you know, it was a real challenge because, you know, it's those three genres, but also the scholarship. You know, there's a lot of scholarship out there, needless to say, about Jesus. And, you know, I tried to hold myself to a high standard by giving it to the best experts, but, you know, that meant a lot of work, you know, when they responded and said, you know, you need to sort of rethink this sentence or something. I had to really give it a lot of thought. So I see this as kind of the book that the other ones were leading up to.
Now, what do you think this book obviously has an audience and people who read America, people who know Jesuit spirituality, Catholics, Christians. Do you see an audience beyond that, people who are seekers, maybe even non-believers?
I hope so, and it's really written for everybody. I say at the beginning of the book, you know, it's similar to what I try to do in the Jesuit Guide, which is to say, I'm assuming you know nothing about Ignatius or the Jesuits or Ignatian spirituality. And I say at the beginning of this book, I'm assuming that you know nothing about the Gospels, you know, or Jesus, but that you can come up to speed pretty quickly. So it's for a seeker, but, you know, an intelligent seeker. And it's also for people who think they, you know, have read everything that they can on Jesus. I'm hoping that they'll find, and I know they'll find new stuff in here. But, you know, I think it's really important to, I sometimes think that I write for the person I was at age 27, which was, you know, hopefully intelligent, but not knowing a whole lot of kind of technical stuff. So at the very beginning, for example, I say, all right, now how are the Gospels put together? You know, and I kind of lead people through that. But as I said, I hope that, and I assume that people can come up to speed in the book pretty quickly.
Yes, that's what I admire about your writing and about this book, is that it's very accessible, but it's also very sophisticated in the arguments you're presenting. I mean, you're not shying away from these complicated ideas.
Yeah, and also I enjoy books, you know, where you know, have someone tell you something you didn't know before. You know, I mean, I was thinking I like to write the kind of book that I like to read. And for example, as I said, one of the things I include is quite a bit of Greek, you know, that's the original language the Gospels were written in. And I think it's fun to say, here's the original. And there's a great passage in the multiplication of the loaves and the fishes where one gospel says that they were arranged like flower beds. The people were in groups of 50. And it's a charming phrase that does not come in the English translation. And some scholars say, what does that mean? It could mean they were like sort of like literally flower beds. You can imagine that shape. But some scholars say that might be an indication of all the colorful clothes that people were wearing. And once again, it does not come out in the English. And so it's a little bit of technical stuff that I think the sort of average reader would be happy to learn about.
Yes, I was going to ask you about the Greek. I mean, we had some amusing conversations about trying to get the typeface just right because you have so many Greek words in there. What maybe speak more about what the Greek brings to your study.
Yeah, well, I am not a Greek scholar. I'm the first person to say that. But I did study Greek during my Jesuit philosophy studies, and I loved it. I loved it. You know, when you go back to the original Greek and learn that there are different ways of translating it, it really makes it much more immediate. And there are some things that even the best English translations just miss. So, for example, in one English translation of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, he says, you know, something like, I am sorrowful until death, right? But the Greek says, you know, my soul is sorrowful until death, you know, which is quite different. And so, you know, I try without being too pedantic to help the reader see, you know, here's the original, and here's what some of the best translations miss. And I think that really adds to Jesus' story. I also point out that there are quite a few Aramaic words in the Gospels. And so, as we know, the Gospels were written in Greek, but they are translating what happened in Aramaic and Hebrew. Scholars say that the Aramaic words that are still preserved, so words like ephatha, you know, be open, which he says to the deaf man's ears, you know, come from Jesus's lips. And so to kind of look at those and remind the readers, here are the authentic words of Jesus, you know, literally, that are preserved for us 2,000 years later. And I've always been very excited about that. So I hope people enjoy a little Greek.
Now, I will say that we're talking here about some of the more sophisticated ideas here, and maybe it's just because that what interests me, but you have some funny stories in here. I mean, that's very accessible. There's stories about your travels with George. Maybe you could speak a bit some of those.
Yeah, well, one of the sort of enjoyable parts of this pilgrimage was that I went with one of my best friends, and I knew, you know, when he said that he'd be available to go with me on this 2-week pilgrimage, that we'd have fun because he's very funny. And so, you know, the book is not all scholarship and spirituality. It's the story, and I'm glad you brought this out, of a pilgrimage, an actual pilgrimage to the Holy Land. And we had fun. You know, we got lost. There's one part where we're going up to the Sea of Galilee and we get lost in the desert. Our GPS was completely, you know, inadequate. And we ended up, you know, being confronted with this Israeli Defense Force guy with a gun. We survived, basically. And he was very friendly and eventually gave us directions to the River Jordan. But I think it's important to kind of draw readers in with humor and you know, and real stories. I mean, this was a real life pilgrimage. And as I said, I was happy that I went with a friend who was so funny and amusing. I told him that it's funny. At one point I said, you know, this is definitely going in the book. And he said, you know, when I would do something embarrassing, he said, oh, I bet you're not going to put that in the book.
He know what he was signing up for?
I think he did, yeah. And actually, I let him read it beforehand, and he didn't have any changes, so that made me happy.
That's good. Well, one of the questions to end with, in terms of the new evangelization and how a book like this can play a role, and you write about this a bit, how can we make the Jesus story kind of more exciting for a new generation who— maybe for some it may seem almost banal or old hat or, you know, a source of parody. People think of, you know, Life of Brian.
Right.
They don't think, you know, how can we kind of make this story radical again?
Well, I think that's a great question. I mean, in a sense, Jesus' story is radical no matter how you slice it. I think the problem is it's been watered down. I think people, in a sense, they're afraid of the gospel. Sometimes they think that might be too daunting. So books are either too bland, and they talk about Jesus without looking at scholarship, or they're too scholarly, and they don't invite people in. So what I'm trying to do is invite people into the story of Jesus in a new way. This is the Jesus I know and love, so it's obviously filtered through my prayer and my faith and my experience and my studies. But it's also the Jesus of the scholars, the Jesus that people have studied, and I try to make that accessible. So it's trying to do both things. It's trying to invite people in a sort of a popular style, but it's also trying to remind people that there are, you know, fantastic scholars out there who can tell us so much about things that we don't know about. I mean, things that we think we don't know about, but there's actually a lot of research that I think will help people, you know, appreciate Jesus more.
Now, was there something about writing this book, just the journey, you know, years it took you to put this together, that kind of brought you closer to Jesus in a way that perhaps not writing it, you know, it was, like, as you said, it was sort of a culminating work for you.
Yeah, I have to say, I was so moved when I was working on this book, not because of what I was writing, but just being able to spend time with Jesus. And I mean, to get a little more personal, when I was writing each chapter, so for example, if I was writing the chapter about the healing of the paralytic by the pool of Bethesda, I was kind of immersed in that. I mean, I would be praying about that every morning, you know, before I started work. I would be reading about it in terms of commentaries. I would be looking at my spiritual journals, and I was kind of consumed with that particular chapter. And then I would move on to the next one. And so I was sad when I ended the book, really. And I would say, I mean, to speak even more personally, I could feel the grace kind of move away from me, you know, because there was a sense of a desire and a sort of drive and an interest in each chapter as I was writing it. And I was really kind of present to that and just sort of, I would say, even kind of obsessed with it. You know, everything I could read about that particular chapter, whatever it was at the time. And I have to say, I told my faith sharing group this and my spiritual director, when I finished the book, I could feel the grace just kind of leave me. The interest that I had in kind of diving into those chapters had just left. And that, you know, that's appropriate. I think God gives you the grace to do what you need to do. And so I read it now and I think, gee, I really put a lot of work into that. So it was a beautiful spiritual experience just to be spending time with Jesus. And I would have liked it to have continued. Obviously I had a deadline with my publisher, but just writing it and, you know, and really what could be better than spending time with Jesus in prayer and in study and in writing. It's probably the most satisfying writing experience I've ever had.
Well, and now it's a gift you share with your readers. You hand it to them and they can begin their own pilgrimage.
Yeah, so thank you.
Well, we want to congratulate you. The book is coming out March 11th, so people can pre-order it up on Amazon or the Nook or whatever they're looking for. So congratulations, and we look forward to talking more about it.
Thank you, Tim. I appreciate it.